Hey there, if you're enjoying The Wild and want us to keep on making more of it, we could really use your help on one small thing. If you could click on the listener survey in the show notes or at kuow.org/thewild, I'd love to hear from you about this season. What you liked, what you didn't, who you are, and the stories you want to hear more of in our next season. And if you do, we'll enter you into a drawing for one of 20 Wild posters signed by me. Thanks. People are in the wild for all kinds of reasons. For some, it's their job, and when it comes to filmmaking, the very best of them are on a mission. A mission to get as close as possible to the animals they are documenting.
Imagine standing in a crowd of 500,000 Joe Pesci's from Goodfellas. It's kind of like that, and they go completely nuts.
That's Jeff Wilson. He's a producer I've worked with before. We became friends among the bears of Alaska filming for the BBC. And he's involved with top shows like Planet Earth, Frozen Planet, and Our Planet.
You know, we're literally sitting in there thinking, this: the roof is going to come off this thing. We're going to die. All the equipment's going to be blown away. And it was just an extraordinary experience.
And that's Mark Smith. He has filmed some of the most memorable scenes you've seen on TV. These guys have become a formidable duo. Remember the scene of the snow leopard chasing its prey off a cliff? That was these guys. This is a tale of fortitude and resilience and the people behind the amazing images you see in wildlife documentaries. Jeff and Mark spent 4 months filming penguins on the coldest and windiest continent on Earth, Antarctica. From KUOW in Seattle, I'm Chris Morgan. Welcome to The Wild. Jeff Wilson and Mark Smith have been to the Antarctic twice to document penguins for Frozen Planet and Disney Nature. They've spent months at the Adélie Penguin Colony at Cape Crozier. Now, Cape Crozier was made famous by early explorers like Robert Falcon Scott, who sent an expedition there in 1911 to gather emperor penguin eggs. The journey was later described in the book, The Worst Journey in the World. Cape Crozier is a barren, frozen landscape. The winds are so fierce that they blow all snow and ice off the ground, leaving bare rock, perfect for Adélie penguins to set up their nests for the mating season. Mark describes the first day he and Jeff arrived at the Adélie penguin colony.
I remember very well. It was a beautiful day. We got everything unpacked and thought, oh, this is going to be a doddle. And it was literally within 24 hours, we went out and the wind started to get up and we got into one of the biggest storms, well, definitely the biggest storm I've ever been in. Winds up to 150 miles an hour and we were stuck in this cabin for 3-4 days.
Wow.
You know, we're literally sitting in there thinking, this: the roof is going to come off this thing, we're going to die, all the equipment's going to be blown away. It was just an extraordinary experience.
Off to a fairly positive start then, hey? Just
yeah, it was.
With that list of things.
Yeah, bear in mind, neither of us had been to Antarctica before. You know, we were literally had been thrown in the deep end. You know, we'd intentionally arrived before the Adélies had come back to the continent of Antarctica, and someone had failed to explain to us that an Adélie colony is basically built on thousands and thousands and thousands of years of decaying dead penguins. And so I remember walking into the colony that first time, mm-hmm. and all you see, for as far as the eye can see, is basically penguin carcasses. And I can distinctly remember thinking, bloody hell, we've got this completely wrong. Someone's going to come and pick us up in 2 months. We won't have filmed a thing because all the penguins are dead. and how are we going to solve this one? Are we going to have to start animating carcasses or something like that to kind of make ourselves look better? But it's a shocking thing because it's, you know, it is literally, you know, the substrate of a penguin colony is just dead.
It's just thousands of years of mummified penguins because nothing really decays there. It just gets, you know, sort of frozen into the ground.
Wow. And then the penguins arrived when? At what point did you start seeing them come back?
So They're pretty faithful to around about October 15th. And that's what we'd sort of taken away from our conversations with the scientists. And I remember we had our big storm and there weren't many penguins around. And then the storm finished after 3 or 4 days and we went down and suddenly they were kind of just arriving, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
I see. And it's just, you see a penguin come over the horizon, there's one that turns into how big is his colony eventually?
Well, it gets up to 500,000. I mean, it's it wasn't at the time, but it is now the largest Adélie penguin colony on the planet. You know, you get 500,000 penguins plus there, 250,000 breeding pairs.
It's pretty impressive. Because, I mean, you're up, the colony is from sea level up this slope. And so when you're up the slope, you get a look out over the sea ice. And when you look out, the actual open sea to start with is maybe, I don't know, 2 miles further out from the shore. And so you're scanning the horizon. Eventually, you'll see these little dots coming, you know, thousands of little dots coming towards you.
And of course, when they start arriving, then the defining thing about an Adélie penguin colony is just chaos. I mean, it's full of dead penguins because that's where they, you know, not many of them make it through the season, but it suddenly ends up being, I remember Mark, you talking about it like being a war zone. It goes from being a very placid, kind of cold, beautiful place to this just chaotic war zone that you then have to try and make a film in.
And war zone in terms of what? Competition between them? Or just the mayhem of the place?
Well, everything's dying. You know, basically, you know, it's for the skuas, for instance, there's these birds, the skuas that predate the chicks. And so, and by January, February, the temperature's gone up, so it's above freezing. So all the frozen mud is now liquid mud. All the mummified penguins that were underfoot are now floating around in this mud. The skuas are killing anything they can. So there's basically a mixture of blood and mud and penguin poo all over the place. And you're wading around in the stuff. And that mixed in with the noise of the colony, the constant noise of the colony, it's most extraordinarily oppressive place to be after a while. It's fine, you know, for a few days, it's amazing. But after 3 months of it, I literally would go down. I'd be there for an hour, and I'd have to walk away up the hill to get to hear myself think.
Really?
Yeah, it definitely had its moments.
You know that there aren't any human noises, and so your entire auditory stimuli is all coming from the natural world, which is an amazing thing. And there was a sound recordist who came down as part of that project who pointed out that this is a kind of place where the sound hasn't changed since Scott and his team were there 100 years ago. There's no overflights from passing jets, you know, you don't hear the sound of generators or cars or anything. It's just exactly the same sound as it has been for millennia. And that's an incredible thing. But like Mark says, when it's 500,000 penguins screaming at you and then you start hearing them, a couple of them say your name after a couple of them, you know, they're going, Jeff! Jeff, Jeff! How's that? You
know, that's definitely true. That starts to play on your mind.
Yeah.
It really does. I heard exactly the same thing.
Yeah. What, Jeff or Mark?
Mark.
Yeah.
Let's talk for a minute about, so you're living basically in a shipping container, it looked like to me, up the hill from the penguins, right? And what was your sort of your daily routine and your eating and sleeping? And I have a list here, eating, sleeping, crapping and bathing. what did your routine
consist
of?
We only did a few of those things in our time.
We tried to hold off the crapping. It's too painful to get outside. The toilet was interesting, actually. The toilet was basically a cupboard attached to the outside of the hut. And so you had to go outside and open this thing. It was shaped like an upright coffin or a bit like a rocket. It was all pointy at one end. And most weathers it was all right. But then, you know, when there was a storm blowing, it really felt like the whole thing was about to take off. So you really, you know, it kind of speeded everything up quite well.
I don't know, I had performance anxiety when the wind was knocking at the door. Yeah, it was hard to get one out.
Mm. Anyway, that was the other
I love
list.
It. I love how quickly it comes around to toilets when you talk into Brits, you know, it's like...
But you know, the extraordinary thing about... I mean, so Antarctica is governed by some very well thought out, very serious rules. So all of that excrement that we were generating, we have to take it with us. You know, it's not as if you're just doing what you would do in most parts of the world, is, you know, going into a hole and burying it at the end. You have to put everything in a bucket and carry it out with you afterwards.
Wow.
So luckily... obviously it's cold enough for it all to freeze, so otherwise it could get really heinous. But this is kind of amazing thing that you think at the end of it you're taking absolutely everything with you. Every ounce of urine, every little bit of poo that you've generated is all coming with you. So it's a
right,
it's extreme, an extraordinary logistics,
the extreme version of leave no trace, right?
It's exactly that.
And when you're in this little shack, it looked like a little shipping container for months or weeks on end, just two of you, maybe three of you. How are you managing to stay sane? You hinted already that you had these moments of fleeting insanity, but how did you stay focused and together?
Good question.
We tried cooking, but that didn't really, we tried cooking lots of things, and they all ended up tasting fairly similar, regardless of what the ingredients were. That kept us going for a little while.
We played games with the... you remember, we played games with the cereal packets.
Yes. So all of the food is American-branded food, so if you're thinking things like Aunt Jemima's, you know, syrup and I don't know, what's the guy on the front of the Kellogg's?
Oh, Quaker
Frosties.
Oats. I don't know what he was called.
Quaker the Quaker Oats, yeah.
Mr. Quaker.
Yeah, anyway, we used to get them down and they'd have little parties with them.
Yeah, I think we'd talk to each other, channeling it through the branded faces of American foodstuffs.
That's
perfectly sane.
By this time, you guys have spent a lot of time together and you got to know each other. There's no place like that to get to get to know each other quicker, is there? And were the things that drove you crazy about each other? I mean, you must know each other so well at this point, you know, but were the things that were like, God, I wish Mark would stop doing that, or whenever Jeff does that, I wish he'd close the toilet door.
I'm sure. Knitting. I started knitting.
I wish you'd stopped knitting.
I was terrible at knitting. I started knitting just to try and take my mind off, you know, being around, you know, the same person all the time, so I could concentrate on that and not have to make conversation. But I was knitting a hat. I found it really difficult to remember how many, you know, when you're going around, when you're knitting the hat, and you've got to remember each one, so you're trying to make it smaller as you go up. And I just couldn't do that. So in the end, that drove me absolutely mad as well.
So it ended up being more of a neck gaiter type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, I can see you've done the same thing, yeah.
The good thing about Mark is that if you leave him to his own devices, he becomes so pissed off with himself that it's impossible for him to get pissed off with you to the same level. So the thing is to just stay quiet, let him go through his cycle, and then let him come out the other side.
The perfect word.
We're not
partner.
Really answering the question, are we?
Do you know, I tell you what, I think, you know, Mark, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but we tend to quite often split up in the colony so that we weren't in each other's presence,
yes.
At least towards the end, you know, quite, so that when we came back at the end of the day, we actually had something to talk about in terms of what we would...
Yeah, what did you see? Penguin.
Yeah, God, me too.
Yeah.
But I think that at least gave us a little bit of something to talk about when we eventually came back to the hut, you know, and were trapped in there for days.
Yeah. So you guys were just filming the Disney nature film as well. And were the circumstances similar as they were during the filming of Frozen Planet?
Yeah, so very similar, yeah. In fact, it was quite interesting because one of the most petrifying things I found about being there before was once you'd experienced, we were talking about that storm and that wind, I remember very clearly the sound of that wind before it hit us, which was like a squadron of 747 jets in the distance. It was like unmistakably, awful.
I do remember that clip of you, Mark, pouring your thermos of tea, and the tea was just flying horizontally across the landscape. None of it ended up in your cup because of the 130-mile-an-hour wind. It was crazy to watch.
I mean, the way that cup of tea experiment came about was that one of the things that, again, is particular to that part of Antarctica is that when you have these really high winds, it can often be a high pressure day in that there's no cloud forms around and there's very little snow on the ground. So actually being able to visualize wind is a very, very difficult thing. There are no trees, there are no bushes, there's no buildings that can kind of show that they're being blown around by wind. So we were trying to figure out on that particular day how to communicate to people back home quite how strong the wind was, because if you just pointed a camera out the window, it looked like just a normal kind of cold, sunny Antarctic day. But, you know, it didn't really reflect how strong that storm was.
We're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, Jeff Wilson and Mark Smith will talk more about Adélie penguins and their amazing resilience in one of the harshest environments in the world.
These two words pop into my head, this fortitude and resilience that you guys had to have, and then the fortitude and resilience of these penguins. Let's switch a little bit to the penguins. You've described this almost like a death zone, but it's almost a place of rebirth at the same time. It's a curious mix, isn't it? Can you explain why these penguins are there and when they're there and what they're doing?
So Adélie penguins, they come back to land, to the mainland of Antarctica to breed, and they do that over a four-month period, and that's between the months of October and February. And in that really short period of time, they've got to do everything. They've got to build a nest, they've got to meet a mate, they've got to mate, they've got to lay eggs, they've got to incubate those eggs, get them to hatch, rear their chicks, and then get them everybody out of the colony by February, by which time the weather starts changing and the sea ice starts building again. So they've got a very, very, very intense period of time in which to kind of do their entire breeding life cycle. And because it's so short, that drives pretty much everything in an Adélie penguin's life during those months, you know. So that's why they're so competitive. That's why they come together in huge numbers. They've just got to get through this breeding period as quickly as they possibly can.
And then the 500,000 of them arrive, these screaming penguins, just down the hill from your container shack. What are they doing when they first arrive there? They just start to gather and huddle together against the elements?
Well, then, first of all, the males arrive back first, and they arrive back to sort of claim their territory. And so they're there for a week or so beforehand, and they're just displaying to themselves, and they're building the nest, and they're collecting, you know, little pebbles and stones, and defending their little 2 feet around that nest. And so at that stage, it's all quite gentle and nice, and they're displaying rather beautifully on their nest, and then after a week, the females come back, and then it all kicks off a bit, because then there's a fair bit of disputes going on, and there's males who don't have females or whose females have died, and so they start roaming around, and they're trying to get another female, and so there's at that point there's a huge amount of fighting going on, and it can be incredibly violent. They'll fight to the death, and the best position in those colonies is sort of in the middle. So because if they're in the middle, they're further away from the skuas who are trying to predate the chicks. So that ideally, you'd find a female and get a nest in the middle. And so to get to that position, you know, you have to fight. So that's when a lot of the action happens, and that's kind of the point at which everything kicks off.
What you have at Cape Crozier is extraordinary juxtaposition of emperor penguins, because there's a small emperor penguin colony there, and you really get to understand the difference between an Adélie and an emperor. And we always thought that kind of the emperors are like stoner penguins, right? They just sit there and they're kind of curious and easygoing, and, you know, they'll come up and say hello, but everyone's pretty calm. And I think it's mainly because they're fairly bird-brained, you know, they're not much as going on between the eyes in an emperor penguin. But an Adélie penguin, conversely, is kind of like a super over-caffeinated penguin. And these guys are on a mission, and they just are, you know, they're bashing the hell out of each other. They're bashing the hell out of us. That they, you know, they are literally on a mission, and no one's going to stop them. You imagine it's kind of like, imagine standing in a crowd of 500,000 Joe Pesci's from Goodfellas. It's kind of like that, and they go completely nuts. But, you know, joking aside, that's what makes the Delis such an amazing subject for filming, is that they have this abundance of character that you can see, you know, even between individuals in the colony, you can see the ones that are slightly more relaxed or slightly more pissed off or slightly more kind of ambitious. It seems extraordinary to say that, but there are distinct differences in the ways that all of those, you know, 500,000 or 250,000 breeding pairs approach life, which is really the definition of character, and that was kind of makes them an interesting subject for film.
Yeah, and so when you get back to your shack, and I know you guys, you've probably got a bottle of scotch to celebrate certain moments with there, you know, what were some of those moments? What were like your high five moments of, oh my God, can you believe that just happened?
Yeah, certainly one was, I was talking about when the males are building their nests out of rocks, and there's some very funny behaviour goes on. We were really lucky to be able to film some of that, which is, you know, mostly the males have to, they're building the nest and they have to walk off to find stones, and they may have to walk, you know, 20, 30 metres to go and find a good collection of stones and then walk back to the nest. And then, but some of the penguins have cleverly worked out that why bother to walk 20, 30 metres when you can just steal stones from the nest next door. And so it's absolutely hilarious to watch that happening, because the poor penguin who's walking, you know, 20 metres, 30 metres back and forth is totally oblivious to the penguin that just nips literally 2 feet away to steal the stones. And, you know, it's such a great bit of behaviour that we managed to get it almost all in one with very little editing needed, because the birds are so close together, you're able to film it very, very easily, and it basically told the story itself. And I think that was definitely one of those moments when we got back and it was just, yes, that is just funny in any language.
That stone stealing is happening a lot, but to get the perfect combination of an animal coming in and out of frame and the other one still being in the background and looking over its shoulder and coming in and having it all happen in real time without the need for an edit is an extraordinary, you know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but it didn't happen on the first day, did it? It's kind of like, that's just persistence and persistence and persistence to be observing and watching and turning over and failing time and time again to get the perfect shot. But you can't better what Mark achieved in that particular sequence. That
amazing.
You know, obviously we're there to capture behaviour, but you want people to understand, you know, at least I do, I want people to understand that penguins are more than just cute and funny. And I think, you know, seeing the fighting and the stone stealing and you know, just some of the things that make them have faults, which in a bizarre way makes them more relatable. I mean, I think personally I find animals that are put on a pedestal and given a whole bunch of wonder completely unrelatable. It's the ones that are slightly angry or have bad days or get pissed off that make them feel much more in connection with human life, you know, much more on a continuum with our characters. And I think Adelies are perfect for that, because you can see that happening.
Right. So you guys have spent so much time in these wild, faraway places that most people will never go to, and then you get to share what you've seen with the rest of the world in these incredible films. How Mark, I'll start with you. How does that make you feel when you see your work on a screen where you've been through that real raw experience and now it's come to the world?
I think from the point of view of a cameraman, it's very difficult to see what you filmed without also remembering all the stuff which you didn't film and missed.
Right.
You know, you're out there and you've seen so much amazing stuff that for whatever reason you weren't able to film.
So it's a painful experience for you, Mark.
Initially, it's a painful experience. And then over time, you forget all that stuff and you see it for what it is.
And what about you, Jeff?
I think, you know, ultimately for me personally, just every time that we put a bit of the natural world on screen, and you know, regardless of the amount of effort that's put into it, is a complete, you know, privilege.
And when you come back from these experiences after being away from home for so long, that re-immersion must be quite difficult and strange, hey? I mean, Mark, what does that feel like, that re-entry?
Well, all I can say is that I think a very good strategy is to have some kind of halfway house where when you come back, that you can, if you can spend a day somewhere else before you sort of revisit the family, then it's a hell of a lot better than if you just go straight back in there. Because you're right, it is quite tough, especially because you've just got used to your way of life, you know, and you go back and you really have to sort of try and slot back into the family and expected to do the washing up and all the things that you're expected to do. And you really, your head is still dealing with 500,000 penguins and death. you're a bit of a basket case. And so quite often I'll just end up going back home, and I definitely remember one occasion I just went back and I just sat on the couch at home for an entire day looking out the window, just wondering what had happened. And so, yeah, mentally it's an interesting thing to deal with.
And with that, Jeff, when you come back, I mean, you've got a lot of time to think about things in these wild places, and then you come back and you might not have that processing time. But when you do, what do these places make you think about our world, or the sort of bigger, broader perspective? I know that's a big question, but
I think we're in the fortunate minority in that it's almost the reverse, where these wild places allow you to kind of have perspective on your own life. You know, you disappear for a month and you don't have the pressures that we all have in our daily lives, you know, in our normal adult, you know, world. And you go out and you get a perspective on everything, and then you come back and you find it a lot easier to deal with. So I actually find it restorative rather than a problem when I come back. You know, I feel like, at least I think I come back a better person, but my wife might say differently. But it does give you just a little bit more of a calm approach to you know, the problems which we all face, which end up being incredibly minor when you look at them from 1,000 miles away.
And your films have been seen by countless millions, I dare say maybe even billions of people at this point. And what do you hope people take away? And in the case of penguins in particular, you know, what do you want someone to feel, do, experience during and after that film?
Well, personally, I think that you have to hope that the audience feels some empathy with those penguins and, you know, understands the struggles that they've gone through, so that when they, you know, people read in the news about, you know, overfishing or, you know, problems in the Ross Sea where the penguins are feeding, is that they're already sensitive to what lives there. And it's not just some disembodied bit of news, but there may be, you know, they can relate to the fact, oh, that's where those penguins, you know, are living. And if it's, you know, if there's a problem there, then these penguins are going to be less well off. And so hopefully, you know, it all adds up bit by bit to making people more sensitive, more aware. For me, that if you can achieve that, then you've achieved something.
And Jeff, you described it as a privilege, but do you see it as an obligation to get the word out as well?
I have always felt that. You know, I come from a family of conservationists, but more and more lately, I kind of really believe or feel strongly that it's really important for us as wildlife filmmakers in the blue chip sphere, is what we call this kind of pure natural history that we do, to remind people that, you know, humans are not the centre of the world in most of the planet. You know, we're so good as humans to put ourselves at the center of every picture, and in fact there is so much going on in, particularly in the natural world, that has absolutely nothing to do with us. And I think it's important really to kind of reestablish that balance occasionally, to kind of tell stories that just have nothing to do with any human whatsoever, and kind of represent the natural world. And to me, that's the truest form of documentary that you could possibly hope for, is just kind of reminding people that there are things happening out there that have absolutely nothing to do with us.
And, it's a good recalibration.
Although we have an effect on it, there are places, and, you know, Cape Crozier is maybe one of the best examples, is that that whole life cycle goes on regardless of any human influence at all, year in, year out, without, you know, for millennia. I think it's really important to kind of break people away from the drama of their daily lives and remind them that there's something else going on in the world that doesn't involve them. And, you know, that's my main drive these days.
Mm-hmm. Guys, I got to say, thanks for letting us into your corner of the wild. It's been really lovely catching up with you and hearing your stories. And I can't wait to hear what people think about this. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris. Great talking to you again.
Jeff Wilson and Mark Smith are filmmakers behind countless nature documentaries, including the recent Disney nature film Penguins. They're also a part of the team behind the new Netflix series Our Planet. To see the clip of their amazing footage of that snow leopard chasing its prey down a steep mountainside, go to our website kuow.org/thewild. The Wild is inspired not just by nature, but by people who work in it, love it, protect it. There's a ton of information on the website if you want to find out more. The Wild is a production of KUOW in Seattle, in partnership with my work at Chris Morgan Wildlife. Our producer is Matt Martin. Jim Gates is our editor. Brendan Sweeney is our managing producer. Our fact checker is April Craig. We had engineering help from Dave Brown. Our theme music is by Michael Parker. I'm your host, Chris Morgan. Thanks for listening.